Do you see something different about the room today? I mean, who does that kind of thing? This building could probably have existed for God knows how long, and there was never a need to have blinders fitted. We've done a few sermons here before as well, but I don't think on those occasions we needed to use a screen. Or even if we did, there was no difficulty in seeing what was on screen. But then last week, if you remember, we had to put something on screen, but some of you could see it, but then the others couldn't. And then the little angels, wherever they are, they decided that things had to change. I don't know where such thoughts come into people's minds. You know, not for a moment did I even expect for someone to go really the extra mile on behalf of all of you who are here to attain Nibbana. This is Nibbana, ladies and gentlemen. Just the thought. So has the ticket prices gone up now? So that they can recover the cost of the blinders? You need to understand, and you got to see why and how people can react in such ways and respond in such ways. You know, they do this because they believe. They believe in this cause. They believe in your Nibbana. What else? Remember the last thing I said at the end of last week's talk? I asked you to be extra careful with your lives because your lives are of immense value. You know, we are not in the process of making doctors or engineers out of you, are we? We are not in the process of making lawyers out of you, or bankers out of you, investors out of you. We are not in the process of making leaders out of you. We are actually simply in the process of getting you one step at a time to your salvation. Nothing more and nothing less. If you get what you want out of this, if you get the best out of this, then you will have attained Nibbana. That's it. The world doesn't become a richer place. Another building doesn't come up. In fact, the more that people are inclined towards Nibbana, they lose their interest in worldly pursuits. They lose their interest in acquiring and hoarding material possessions. So actually, in some senses, the world loses out. It's a loss to them. And despite that, the fact that the management of the school have decided to go all this way to install these blinders so that you can sit down in this hall and listen to the sermons in comfortably, without the sun getting in your eyes, without the heat getting in your way and making you feel uncomfortable. That's just, I don't know what the word is for that. It's simply incredible. This is evidence that they believe in Nibbana. See, sometimes people tend to think that only people who have been fatigued by life, exhausted by life, they are the only people who believe in Nibbana or at least some sort of salvation. But that is not so. This is why I always say, our quest, this Nibbana, is a purely mental affair. Your material successes have nothing to do with it. Go on to achieve the greatest of heights that you can. Go on to achieve the pinnacle of your career, and that's perfectly fine. But in the meantime, make sure that you dedicate a portion of your life, whatever you can manage, towards the cause of your salvation, nothing more, ladies and gentlemen. If you attain Nibbana, how do I benefit out of that? How does the next man benefit out of that? Yes, you will be a kinder person, you'll be more gentle, you'll be harmless. Your association will be a good one for them. It will only be a blessing to them. All of that is true. But normally, people don't tend to support individuals who are on the quest to Nibbana because they don't tend to get anything out of it. You know, it's fine to be the friend of a good businessman and you want to keep on their good books, you want to remain on their Christmas card list because one day they're going to get somewhere and you're going to benefit out of that. So, you tag along, don't you? This is how the world works. But then when someone says, I'm going to give up the whole world, there's nothing of interest to me. Maintaining this mundane life and sustaining all this makes no meaning to me. It gives me no satisfaction. So I'm on a quest to achieving salvation where ultimately I know I'm going to let go of everything. And then for someone to get behind them and support them, that's just incredible. I was just talking yesterday with someone. You know, we've been doing these sermons for how long now? How many months? Give me a rough number. About 11 months? Yeah, so almost a year, right? When we were looking for a hall to do these talks, so we asked around, living outside the city of Colombo, we are not familiar with what prices are and what availability is and so on. This being a weekend, and to accommodate an audience like yourselves who can come here, sit comfortably, you know, because we can't make our minds up to just put you just about anywhere, right? Because we attract a certain kind of audience and also we receive people who visit us from abroad. So we are all about hospitality and we want to make sure that everyone feels comfortable, they feel safe. When you park your car outside, you know, you don't come in a bullock cart. Those cars, they cost a fortune. So we want to make sure that they are safe, they're protected, they're secure while you're here, so that at least, you know, when your car's outside, you don't need to worry about it. You can focus on the Dhamma. Whereas if you park by your car by the street, now how can you focus on the Dhamma? If you hear a large container drive past, your mind's already back at your car. You're thinking, oh God, I hope he hasn't. You know what I mean? But while you're here, you have no such worry because you know you're in safe hands. To find a place like that, we looked long and hard. A minimum of up to 75,000, 80,000, 1 lakh per session. That's how much it was going to cost. Now we've been doing these sessions for about 11 months. That's every week. Can you see the size of the donation that they have made to the cause of Nibbana? The commitment that they have made to the cause of Nibbana? This is not to an individual. This is to the Buddha, if you like. Or else, it is to the Sambuddha Sasana. What do they get out of it? You know, we call these talks Gateway to Nibbana. It was not on their request. Because normally you expect something out of it, right? You'd have thought, someone might have thought, did they ask you, did the management ask you to name it Gateway to Nibbana? Are you kidding me? People don't do that kind of thing. Especially if they understand what true Nibbana is. It was a play on words. Because we wanted to get the message out that it was at Gateway College. And it is, of course, a gateway to Nibbana for all of us, isn't it? Has it not been one? Well, there you go. So it was simply a play on words. But at no point did anyone come up and suggest a name. At no point did anyone ask for any kind of advertisement or to get the name out there, get it on our Facebook page, on YouTube. Not at all. Not one word of it. Expecting nothing but giving whatever and everything they can. That is a true mark of selfless giving. This is charity as I understand it. Incredible. Incredible. And you know what's even more incredible? You only get what you deserve. You don't get what you desire. So what does that tell you about all of you? you deserve the best. And that is why you have received the best. I can't think of a better venue than this to do these talks. You deserve the best because you are an abundance of merits walking on two legs. And that is why you deserve not just this, but also this, the Dhamma. Listening to the Dhamma, haven't you realized that you deserve the best? Is that not evidence to you that you have come a long way in samsara and you have accumulated an unthinkable amount of merits just listening to the Dhamma and the impact that it is having on you? See, all things considered, we really have to think about how fortunate we are. And this comes back to what I left you with last week once again. You know, when you are sitting on a gold mine such as this, the sasana and every opportunity, every comfort that has been made available for you to practice the path, please take this opportunity seriously. And this is a request that goes to each and every one of you. I can't be safe on your behalf, as you can understand. I can give you the truth and I can swear to you this is the truth and nothing but the truth. But outside of these four walls, you have to keep yourself safe, ladies and gentlemen. Think of yourself as a mother. If you are a mother to a newborn child and you know that you are the only refuge to your child, yeah, mothers, you understand what I mean? If you know that you are the only refuge to your child, if you know that you are the only source of strength to your child, how much do you look after your lives? Perhaps if you go back a little bit further, remember when you were pregnant with your child. Remember the length that you went to keep yourself safe. And if you are the father of the child that was to be, remember how much you protected your wife. So that the mother of the child to be was safe, she was secure, she had every comfort. Remember those days? Take a trip back memory lane. Remember? You sometimes gave up your bad habits. Maybe you smoked before that, but you gave that up. Maybe you took a drink once in a while, you gave that up. Right? Maybe you went around entertaining yourselves, having fun, but then you gave that up because you sacrificed yourself for the sake of your child. Remember, this was a child you were going to leave behind. Either you were going to leave them behind or they were going to leave you behind. Today, where is that child? They've left you already. They may still be alive, but they've left you. Today, they live with someone else. Your son-in-law, your daughter-in-law. Today, they've left you. But that child, remember how far you went to look after it. Even when it was yet to be born, and then after it was born, because you were the mother and you were the source of inspiration, love, affection, and you knew that no one in this world could give as much as you could to your child. So therefore, you did not only keep your child safe, but you kept yourself safe. Do you remember these days? Now let's come back to Nibbana. Allow me to draw a reference, a parallel there. A child was something you were going to lose. And that was the inevitable truth. I'm here to offer to you Nibbana. If you do it right, you're never going to lose it. So how much should you protect yourself then, now that you are on the quest to Nibbana? How much do you think you've got to keep yourself safe and secure? That's why I said, if someone drives up ahead of you, give them way. Don't you lower that window and start to throw out a few explicits. Don't you be using foul language. Don't you show that you're angry. Don't mock them. Don't show them the, you know what, finger. Please, don't do that. Because today, you're all mothers. And what's the child called? Nibbana. So just as a mother loves her only child and keeps her safe to ensure that her child receives every bit of motherly love, care and affection, I ask you all on this day, please remember these words for the rest of your lives, or at least until you attain Nibbana. Remember these words. Keep yourself safe, because you are now on a quest to attaining something serious. This is once in life, you are doing something useful. Once. this is once in life, you're doing something you will never have to do again. Everything else, you've done it a million times over. And if you are born again tomorrow, you will do again. Every other thing. This is the one thing that is worth doing. Now that you're all on that path, look after yourselves. Keep yourself safe. I can give you the Dhamma, Dhammo have rakkati Dhammachari. That much I can do for you. I can give you the Dhamma, but I can't take the Dhamma on your behalf. I can throw the ball at you, whether you take it, pick it, catch it, or drop it. Who decides? That's down to you. But in any case, please love yourselves as much as I love you. Is that too much to ask? You think I don't? Do you know the risk that I'm taking with my life to bring myself here every week? I don't set foot outside of the monastery unless my life depends on it. Because I know the risks today that are involved, and the stakes are high. The stakes have never been so high. As a husband to a wife, I used to look after myself. Yes, a little bit. As someone who had gotten education because my parents had spent on my behalf, I looked after myself. As someone who was a leader to a bunch of people, I looked after myself. But today, I have something very precious to protect, an opportunity to attain my salvation. I know that if I lose this life, I'm going to lose a heck of a lot. Because the same merit doesn't strike twice. I'm dead serious about this, ladies and gentlemen, and I want you to be the same. The same merit doesn't strike twice. Because once it's consumed, it's consumed. It's a bit like money. You spend it, you spent it. If you want it again, you have to earn it. Most months, this is the only trip I take outside of the monastery, unless I have to go and get myself checked up by a doctor or someone. And even then, the doctors visit us at the monastery. That's how good they are. You know, there are doctors who say, Swami Nohan, sir, the Swami Nohan says the Anagarikas and the Anagarikas, getting outside the monastery is not safe. Why? Because you're on four wheels. People drive erratically. And you don't know, as much as you keep yourself safe, who knows? What can you say about the other person approaching you? They could be drunk. They could have had a long night, without sleep. They could have just come after a night shift. And they're hazy. And then you put yourselves out there, and if you lose your lives, then what refuge do we have? So doctors visit us at the monastery so that we don't need to step outside of our four walls. Most of our monks, so ever since they became Anagarikas, they don't know what the outside world even looks like. Do we need to? We've never had the need to. Because you've always been there. You're always there as a strength, as a pillar of strength to all of us. If ever we need something, all we have to do is make it known. And whenever you can, it arrives at the monastery. We have doctors who visit us. Even, you know, there are bankers. If for whatever reason we needed to open a bank account for an insurance plan or whatever that is available to a monk, officials from the bank, they visit the monastery. They bring in all the forms. They bring in all the ID verification, whatever things they have, and they say, Saminas, you don't need to go out. The Gramaniladhari, he visits us at the monastery. Say, Saminas, you don't need to go out. It's alright. You can save your time, practice the path. Let us do that, because that is something we can do on behalf of the Sasana. But what you're doing, we cannot do. And likewise, what you're doing, I cannot do. Frankly, I don't need to do. But then after all that, every Sunday, I have no choice. I have to come this way. For the best part of 2.5 hours, I'm on the road coming from Ingiriya to Rajagiriya, and then about 2 hours on the way back from Rajagiri to Hingiri. Who can guarantee my life? Put your hand up. Who can vouch for my safety? Thank you. I know what you mean. Who can vouch for this Anagarika Mahatma's safety? He has come here all the way from Germany. If his mother knew the risks that we put him through, bringing him all the way from Hingiri to Rajagiri once a week, if his mother knew, if his father knew, they were born Catholics and hardened Catholics as well. But for his sake, he was a scientist. Anagarika Mahatma was a scientist, he was a physicist. And so he started to look at the world through a different lens. So some of the answers that he got from his elders, from his parents, they didn't satisfy him. It just didn't make sense, didn't add up. So he looked for a different kind of answer. He looked for an answer that he could be happy with. And then he found the truth. You call it Buddhism. He calls it the truth. Some might call it Buddha Dhamma. We call it the truth. He calls it the truth. So now that he's found the truth, he's come here to study the truth. What's he studying? The truth. Is he a Buddhist? No, he's a truist. Truism is his philosophy. But you think it was easy to get his parents' consent? His mother has promised to visit him for his ordination, but not the father. Yet. But if his mother knew, we were bringing him down every week, all this way, I'm putting his life on risk, or at risk. You know, in the developed part of the world, people abide by road rules, right? You have to keep to your lanes, whatnot. You can't overtake on the left. But here we're a little bit more relaxed, put it nicely. You know what it's like. And you know, you think I don't have a responsibility for this young man's life? If ever anything would happen to him, you know what his mother's gonna do? I'll have to answer to her. But despite that, right, from the day he was here, he's been coming along. Wants to keep Swami Nuhanse safe. Wants to make sure that this place is set up for all of you, so that you can come and sit down and watch all this. All I have to do is say, put that one, put this one, and then they do the rest of it. And even if you have to stop by somewhere for an emergency, right? It's not graceful for a Swami Nuhansi to be running around, you know, doing whatnot. So the Anagarika Mahatmas, they do all that. You know, I just wanted to think about what people who believe in Nibbana are willing to do for someone else's. This is evidence of that. You know, in these moments, they don't think about how much it costs. They don't. Money you can earn. What's a rich man? Who has a lot? Or who understands? When you give, you get. That's a rich man. A rich man is someone who has a rich mindset, a rich attitude. That's why most people, they don't have. The majority of this world are poor. A minority are rich. Why so? Because this world is unfair. No, this world is fair and square. You cannot find a fairer world than this. It is fair and square. What you give is what you get. Those who haven't got, they haven't given. Whose fault is that? the lawmakers, the politicians? No. You know, this philosophy, it empowers each and every one of us. Now, we are not at the mercy of someone else. I'm here to teach you a philosophy whereby you are not even at the mercy of God. Unless you want to redefine God. In which case you understand that God is give or deny. What you give, you get. What you deny, you are denied. That is God. And that's what God does anyhow. I don't think He'd, even if He did exist, I don't think He'd have an issue with that. He would agree, yeah, that's what I do. If for those who have given, I give. To those who have denied, others, I deny. Because they have to be punished for their sins. So that they learn. And He'll say, I do it out of mercy. I do it out of kindness. And that is how I show my love, He might say. But today, you're understanding this philosophy, you know, today you understand how God thinks. Don't you? If you want to get something, what should you do today? Go to the Devali and make offerings? It's fine to make an offering as long as you understand that offering is what gets you. Not just because it's the Devali. Offering is what gets you. Giving is what gets you. That's why it works. Not because there's a deity somewhere watching over you and, you know, a deity that you have to satisfy. There's not a God that you have to satisfy. Then you'd have to say that God was selfish. You know, if God is all so merciful, then why is it that I have to keep satisfying Him? If He loves me unconditionally, why is it that He only gives me if I satisfy Him and make Him happy? Why doesn't He love me unconditionally? One could ask. See, our brother from Germany, he questioned these things. And he was looking for answers, and he found them. He says he's still a scientist. And I want him to forever be one, just as I want you all to be. Free thinkers. I don't want to restrict the way you think. This is not brainwashing. If you like, this is mindwashing. When your mind is free of defilements, you are free to think, ladies and gentlemen. Today you are not free to think. If you like these flowers, you can't take your eyes away from them. You are not free to think. If there's something in the fridge which you like the taste of, you can't walk away from it. Even when you know it's not good for you, you're not free to think. You are not a free thinker unless you have been healed by the Dhamma. That's what we're here for, to heal ourselves. This, on the weekdays, this is a school. On weekends, this is a hospital. Welcome to all our patients. The doctor has arrived. Not me, that's the doctor. I'm only the nurse. And the doctor wishes to prescribe his medicines to you and diagnose you now. So, if you've been waiting long enough, let's proceed. So let's bring our palms together in veneration then. Of the greatest father we have ever seen, the greatest mother this world has ever been blessed to receive, a mother whose love is infinite, a father whose gracefulness is infinite, a friend whose nobleness knows no limits or bounds. It is He who has brought us together today to practice the path and to achieve our salvation. We are here because of Him. We are here because He took the effort, went the extra mile, to deliver us the Dhamma and establish the community of the Sangha. And to His holy name we make this veneration. නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස නමෝ තස්ස භගවතෝ අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්දස්ස. Last week, I think, might have been a little bit heavy for some of you. You might have had a chance to go back and watch the previous Saturday's sermon. If you did, then good. But I know that not everyone has the luxury of time, because time is, of course, these days, a privilege. But here's something I just want to make sure we all understand. Although this sounds, all this that we've been talking about sounds very sciencey, the ultimate conclusion that we are trying to lead this conversation to is simply that what you sense as a self is merely an illusion of the mind. That is the ultimate goal. Because if everything we talk about is not aimed towards that, then we're just talking rubbish, really. I mean, it is not in line with the Buddha's teaching. Because whatever we talk about, ladies and gentlemen, it has to align to the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth is the noble truth of suffering. Today, most people understand suffering in a very mundane way. Although all of that is encompassed, when we talk about suffering, the suffering that you get out of fear, grief, right, grievances, anxieties and stress, mental and psychological disorders, and how people suffer because of that, all of that is all suffering. It's all encapsulated within the word suffering. But, let's be honest, you don't need the Buddha's help to understand that, do you? Haven't people always cried at the death of a loved one before and after the Buddha? Many years, a day before the Buddha was born, didn't people die? And didn't people cry as a result of that? Because of the suffering that they experienced? So that suffering cannot be the suffering that the Buddha speaks of, because he himself says, this truth that I have realized, no one in this world has ever seen before the Sammasambuddha, that is, I have realized this. It is only from here on, by listening to my instruction or the instruction of those who have heard it from me, will another soul understand this truth. The Four Noble Truths are not a mundane thing, ladies and gentlemen. We are all privileged to have some connection to the Buddha. If someday you understand exactly what the Buddha meant by the first noble truth, let's leave the other three to the side for a second. If you understood what the Buddha meant by the first noble truth, on that day, I'll have you know that you are now connected to the Buddha. There is no other way that we can understand the first noble truth. Because day-to-day suffering, everyone knows it's suffering. When someone takes something that doesn't belong to you and you haven't given it to them willingly, don't you suffer? So, piyehi vipayogo dukko. What is dear to me, what is near to me, what I like and what I love, if someone takes it from me, it is a cause of suffering. Surprise! You know, it is because people look at Buddhism through that lens, they wonder, I know what the Buddha taught. All right, Einstein. That's how people think. You don't need the Buddha to come and tell us that. We know that suffering, you know, it's everywhere. Everyone understands suffering. A she-dog, a mother dog cries when she loses a puppy. And, you know, you don't even need to be human for that. So if we undermine the Buddha's first noble truth that the Buddha taught to be the suffering that we all have understood even before we came across the teaching, then, you know, we are worlds apart. We need to come to our senses that that cannot be the suffering that the Buddha spoke of. It cannot be. Otherwise, the Buddha is just making up stuff. And he's as bad as the next one. He's a liar just as the next one. For some reason, he came around and he said, I have understood the truth that no one has ever seen before, and he was lying all along. It cannot be. Because you and I, we understand the Buddha in whatever little way we can. We realize that he came into this world to teach something. It must be something special. It must be something special. Right? At least from what you have heard, it must be something special. It might be that I haven't fully grasped the extent, the gravity of what he explained, but it cannot be the suffering that I've always known, because then I've always been a Buddhist. You know, take the five ascetics for instance. The five ascetics, the Buddha met. Right, when he became a mendicant and went around, he was looking for his salvation, and he met the five ascetics. You see, these five ascetics, what do you think they were on a quest for? What do you think they were looking for? Liberation. They were looking for the truth. In other words, they were looking for freedom from suffering. So, did they not know suffering then? So then why did the Buddha have to preach the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta? And then the Venerable Kondanya, he was the first to realize the Dhamma. How can that be so if suffering was always there? And he, as an ascetic, before becoming the Venerable Kondanya, the Sotapanna Kondanya, if that was the same suffering that the Buddha had preached, then what was this special realization? That's the thing. See, we see suffering from a very superficial level, ladies and gentlemen. Human beings, animals, all sentient beings, we see suffering from a very superficial level. You know, the other day I was thinking to myself, scientists, they study human behavior. They even study mind behavior. They can only study mind behavior though. They might call it cognitive psychology. How the mind behaves in certain situations. Behavioral psychology. I have a psychology student here. He teaches me psychology from time to time. Not because he needs to. Our Swami Nuhansa is studying psychology so that he can preach to an audience who have taken refuge in psychology. Psychology is the greatest. You know, there are people like that. Just like there are people who believe physics is greatest. Chemistry is the greatest. Science is the greatest thing. The best thing that man has ever discovered, science. But then to speak to an audience like that, especially people who don't yet have the merits to understand it. So you know I'm not talking about you. You know I'm not talking about you. Today I don't need to come here and convince you that what the Buddha taught was something way beyond what Einstein discovered. Even if you haven't fully grasped exactly what the Buddha meant, it may be that all of you have, but it may be that some are yet to. You still understand, no, when you put Einstein and Buddha on scale, right, incomparable. And you know which way around that is also. But there are those who have taken refuge in science, just as I was when I was a layman, before I had come across the Dhamma. The thinking that I had was, if science can prove it, it must be true. If science can't prove it, no. No, don't even bring it anywhere near me. I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. That's the way I thought about it. So our Swami Nuhansa, 20? He hasn't even received his higher ordination yet. He's studying psychology so that he can then relate the Buddhist principles, the concepts of Dhamma, to an audience who revere psychologists. You see the length we are willing to go to get this to people? You know, you think the psychology that he learns he's going to take with him when he goes? When he's dead, hopefully he'll die for the last time, Others will have a word with you. But, you know, when he's dead, he won't remember any of the psychology he's learned. You know, the first time I asked him to do this, he came up to me. And there are a few young Swaminarayanas at the monastery who are learning this as a subject. You know, they came up to me and said, "Swaminarayana, is it really worth it, us doing this? You know, some of the things that I learn in my psychology books, I realize this is child play. It's like we are now at university and you're asking me to read a book from Montessori. This is nursery stuff. Must I learn this stuff when I know that none of this is actually the truth? This is simply the tip of the iceberg when we have seen the other end of it as well. Must we do this?" But then, out of compassion for mankind, and because for some people, unless you walk up to a stage and sit down and say, "I know a thing or two about psychology, let me share a few things with you." And then they listen to that, then they're impressed. "Oh, this man knows what he's talking about. Let's see what else he has to say." Is to break that ice. What age did you ordain? 15. Yes? So he ordained at the age of 15. He's 20 years now. If he walked up to a stage, you know, to an audience and said, "I'm only 15 years old. I don't have any credentials to my name. I don't have a PhD, I don't have an MSc, I don't have a BSc, I don't have any of those things, I haven't even passed my A-levels, and I have something to tell you." The room will be empty before you can know it. Not everywhere, most places. Especially if they don't have the merits. Because people are constantly measuring themselves with each other. "Why should I listen to a 15-year-old? What does he know that I don't? I've lived twice his age. What does this little thing know about Buddhism? He's probably, you know, his parents probably gave him up to the sasana because they couldn't afford to look after him." May I have you know that they're both doctors? Both his mother and father. So why have they given him up to the sasana? They didn't give him up to the sasana. They gave the sasana to him. That's what they did. That's why mothers, you know, they're scared about giving up their children to the sasana. It's like giving up their daughter in hand in marriage. Giving up. That's what they think. "I have to give up my son. I have to give up my daughter. My daughter's hand in marriage to a stranger. Who knows what they're going to do after that? I'll never see him again. I'll never see her again." It's not so when it comes to the sasana. Ladies and gentlemen, you don't give anyone up to the sasana, you give the sasana to them. This is a gift. You don't give someone up to the gift, you give the gift to them. Right? That is what his parents have done. If he'd remained a layman, by this point, he'd be in university in Scotland. That's where they were. At a very young age, he left Sri Lanka with his parents. He went there with his sister. Very well-to-do people. Professionals. Doctors. What more can I say? People who have studied science to the nth degree. They understand how this works. They understand how this works to some extent. They understand psychology. What they don't understand is the mind. Here, we learn mindology. That's why people, you know, scientists, they know psychology, which is behavioral psychology and cognitive psychology, mainly. There may be other schools of thought, but mainly these two camps. They're still studying about behaviors. But I don't think, this is what I was thinking to myself the other day, I don't think there's ever going to be a day that science can actually identify an individual mind and talk about it. Because of the scientific method. The scientific method is an empirical one. Meaning, you have to trial. You have to do experiments. And those experiments teach you. See, here's the deal. How can a crazy man ever realize that he's crazy? You tell me how that works, I'll tell you the day that science is going to discover the mind. Not the mind in the way that science understands it, the mind in the way that the Buddha taught it. You tell me how a crazy man can come to self-realization that they are crazy? How is that possible? How is that possible? It's not. How can that be? You know when you look at a crazy man. How do you know that when you see a crazy man? How is that possible? Because you are not. Yeah? Sure? You go to the asylum, right? Take yourself to the mental hospital and ask the first person you meet, where are the crazy people in this place? I don't mean the staff. Ask the patients, where are the crazy people in this place? You know who they're going to point at? They'll point at the doctor. They'll point at the staff. You know what they'll be saying? These people, don't say these things out loud because then they put you into a dark room. Right? There are some people in coats. Right? There are some people with a stethoscope around their necks and they take us into these rooms and they start doing funny things to us. They are crazy. And they sometimes ask us to take these pills. I don't know why they do that. And then they come up to us and they do these all sorts of funny things. And they put us into these machines and then they put electrodes on my head. And I don't know, they're crazy. Who's saying this? The crazy man says this. Not for a moment does he realize that he's the one who's crazy. Because self-realization, there's only once in the history of mankind, at least in the history that we know of, where a crazy man discovered that he was crazy. Who was that? The supremely enlightened one. It takes an incalculable eons, an incalculable period of time to endure the paramita that it takes, to earn the merit that it requires, and an infinite amount of selfless sacrifice to ultimately realize, I am the crazy one. And that moment of realization is the moment you come out of that craziness. In other words, the self falls apart. That, I don't see how a psychologist or a psychiatrist or anyone who studies psychology as a science will ever come across, because how can they make an assessment about a mind when they have the same predicament? When they're in the same situation, when you and I are in the same boat, how can I help you? How can a crazy mind look at another mind and go, you're crazy? What do I mean about this craziness? I mean the self. See, this is what we're trying to understand. So like I said, although what we're studying, what we're talking about, the last few weeks and maybe today as well if you have some time, it sounds a little bit science-y, the intention is not to teach you science. This is not in this school, they teach you lots of science. So I don't need to do another lesson on a Sunday morning. Right? For that you can come in from Monday to Friday. This is not to teach you science. I'm making use of a little bit of science to actually come to a different conclusion. And that conclusion is, you are nothing more than a chitta. You are not the mind that you sense you are. Right now you might identify yourself as an individual. When you think about yourself, think about yourself for a second. When you think about yourself, when you focus your attention on yourself, you're probably thinking, yes, I know who I am. I am me. I have a name. I'm me. I've been giving myself speeches for God knows how long. That's the first speech I ever gave. And ever since then, I've been adding information about myself to my database, and now I know a lot about who I am. Those days, I only knew about my favorite color and my favorite toy and my favorite food and so on. But today, I know even the things that go on inside of me, and this is all me. Today, I have a favorite person. I have a favorite place I would like to be. I have favorite things I'd like to do. This is all me. Unfortunately, none of that is true. That is the illusion that your mind creates for itself. Now, don't take my word for it, because I know you can't. You know, it doesn't work like that. Just because Swami knows this, so yeah, it must be illusion. It doesn't work like that. I mean, a scientist doesn't do that. You can't just take my word for it, and please never do. I'm here to give you evidence of that, to try and help you understand that one step at a time. Your mind is a series of chittas. That is what you are. A series of chittas. Each chitta is a discrete instance of energy. Now, as I say these things, do try and make sense of this. The day that you actually have this, aha, got it, right? On that day is the only day you're actually going to realize this and actually going to, that's the day that this will have internalized. That's the day that you will be looking at it and seeing it in the way that I'm trying to explain this to you. But until then, hang in there and try and come along with me. Your merits will be your guide. Nothing more. Sometimes I wonder, you know, why do these people actually come and sit down here and listen to everything I say when it probably doesn't make sense a lot. It doesn't probably make a lot of sense. I understand if it doesn't make a lot of sense, because, you know, all your life you've been thinking about yourself, and today I come and tell you that that is a lie. Why would you believe that? Haven't you always felt yourself? Right? If I asked you to speak up, is any of you to come up here and talk about yourself? Right? You would say all sorts of things. I am so and so. I am this many years old. I am a mother. This is my husband or this is my father. I have many friends. I hold this position in society. I work at this place and I've been working there for this long. Right? These are my favorite things to do. These are my favorite places to be. This is what I like to do in my spare time. These are my hobbies. And so on. You know, you just keep on talking about yourself. And it doesn't seem out of order, does it? Not one bit does it seem like, no, that doesn't sound right. So, in fact, what I'm telling you now doesn't sound right. Because I'm giving you something that is completely at odds with everything you believed in. Right up until you heard these words. Your very identity is now put under the microscope. That is what we are doing here. Are you who you think you are? That's a very profound question. It digs deep. Are you who you think you are? See, even back then, this was the question that was put to the Buddha. Many people were looking for this answer. They were riddled by this problem, ladies and gentlemen. Because, you know, there were those who could see previous lives. They had that ability. You don't need to be a Buddha or an Arahant to be able to do that. If you can focus your mind enough, you can start seeing your previous lives. So people were able to do that. And then they would see that, although today I'm a human being, in my previous lives I was a Deva. In a life before that I was a monkey. In a life before that I was an elephant. And then again I was a human being. And then back then I was a man, today I'm a woman. See, people were able to see these things. And then they wondered, okay, so the body breaks down, get that. And then each time I come into this world, I build new relationships with people, I have a different identity. I learn new things about myself. Today I'm a man, but yes, you know, in my previous life I thought I was a woman, and at that point I had no doubt that I was a woman. I never felt like, you know, I was a man but I'm a woman, or I'm a woman but I'm a man. I never felt that, you know, my gender, there was no question, no doubt about it. But what was it that transcended? What was it? What was that thing, that entity that traveled in samsara? What is it that was there many lifetimes ago? What is it that will be there in my next incarnation? What is it that incarnates? Here's the problem that people ask. Even in these talks, I'm informed by the people who watch our you know, people post questions on our YouTube channels and so on, and some send in emails and so on. So I'm informed by some of our people who do that. So I'm informed that there are still people who ask questions like this. When you say that seeing is a process, there are those who ask, who is it that sees? They'll say, Swami, I get it. Seeing is a process. But who is it that sees? Missed it. you probably have the same question. Who is it that sees? That is dukkha. That is the first noble truth of suffering. Yourself. You identify yourself as an entity. You think it is you who sees, and there's a process of seeing. There's a process of thinking. There's a process of smelling, tasting, experiencing. All of these processes, they're happening to whom? They're happening to me. That is the mind gone crazy. But again, don't take my word for it. This is what we're here to learn. At this university, we dispel this myth. We put yourself on the examination table. We dissect that. And we help you to understand one step at a time. You know, if this takes you the next 8 years, I say so be it. But just make sure you hang in there for the next 8 years, okay? We don't know when this realization might happen. It might happen to you today. It may have already happened to you. It might happen to you tomorrow. We don't know when it's going to happen to you, but I'll tell you something. It will only happen to you when you're listening to a talk. There is no other way that realization can come to you for the first time. It has to be when you're listening to a Dhamma talk. So you can't meditate yourself out of it unless, of course, you are a Paccheka Buddha or a Sammasambuddha. Those two, capable. They meditate themselves out of self. It's like a man who doesn't know to swim. You put them in a deep end, he comes out of it unscathed. Now, that's a miracle. Yeah? That's what we talk about when we... That's a fitting analogy for the Buddha. He doesn't know how to swim. But he teaches himself how to swim while he's trying to stay afloat. But plenty of times he's drowned and he's died. But every time he has another go, he strives, he makes effort. And then finally, he learns how to swim and he gets out of the water. That's a Buddha. And then he teaches others how to swim. Fortunately for you and I, we don't have to keep drowning like that because we have a teacher now who can teach us how to swim. So that's a fitting analogy. Excuse me. All this sciencey stuff then is simply to help you all realize this reality that it is not a self, it is not a you that suffers. There is suffering. It's the chitta that suffers. You've seen me put this on the board in the past, and I'll do it again. I like to draw this to represent your chitta. The problem is, when I say the word your chitta, once the truth, the other's alive. Half of this is true, half of it is a lie. Which one's the truth? The chitta. That's the truth. What's the lie? Your chitta. Now it's okay. What's that? You are chittas. The other day, Mr. Daniel was giving me this example. Permission to borrow? Thank you. Because we have a Dhamma discussion once a week. I want to make sure that he's well looked after, right? He had a wonderful question he asked. He said, you know, when I contemplate on the Dhamma, he said, Swami Nuansa, I wonder about this. I wonder whether there are atoms that make up this pen, or are these the atoms themselves? Are the atoms themselves the pen? or are there atoms that make up the pen? See, when you look at this pen, your mind tells you that there are atoms that make up this pen, right? There are atoms that make up this pen. That's how you perceive it. So then let's take out all those atoms that make up this pen. What's left? If you take out all the atoms that make up this pen, what's left? So then did the atoms make up the pen, or were they just the atoms themselves? These are those atoms. It's not that the atoms make up the pen. These are the atoms. In this aggregation, in this combination, in this configuration, in this arrangement, we refer to this arrangement as a pen. Does that make sense? Give me either this or give me this, one or the other. Yes? Thank you. It's not that the pen is made out of atoms. These are atoms. Well, how about this one then? Is the fan made out of atoms? Then, these are the atoms. It's just one arrangement of atoms. This is another arrangement of atoms. Right? Okay, come back to the chitta. Sorry. I'm bursting your bubble, I know it. I am mean, I know it, yes. I do this for kicks. I come and burst your bubbles every Sunday. And I make life unlivable, don't I? I come here every Sunday and I question, do you actually think you're a wife? Are you actually a wife? You think you're a loving husband? Are you really a husband? And then you have to go back home and live like a loving husband. This is why, you know, with your understanding of the Dhamma, there comes a point where you come and ask me, Swami Nansa, I don't know, Swami Nansa. I feel like I'm on a fence now. Before listening to your talks, I was okay. I was okay being crazy. But now, Swami Nansa, I know I'm crazy. And that's more difficult than not knowing I'm crazy. Now what do I do? I say, slow down, sir, slow down. I don't feel like I can live this crazy life anymore. Can I take the leap? Can I jump over to the other side? I said, are you ready? I don't know, Swami Nansa. I still enjoy some of these things. Right? But I know that this enjoyment is just utter nonsense. But still I feel desire. I feel like I want it. I feel I can't be without it. But I know I'm crazy. What do I do, Swami Nansa? Please help. I said, I am helping. I've been helping. For the last 11 months I've been helping. What are you talking about? This is helping you. But if you don't feel you're ready for it, don't jump just yet. Like, no, jump back over to the other side, to the safe side, to your side, the side you were on. Just jump back. When you're ready, take one jump. You need not be on the fence. You need not be on the fence. Either be on this side fully or be on that side fully. You need not be on the fence. So while you're on this side meaning not this side, the crazy side, while you're on the crazy side, listen to the Dhamma. Let the Dhamma run in through these ears and don't let it run out the other ear. Let it make a difference in you. Let it make an impact on you. Let it transform you. Let it change your thinking habits. It's your thinking that has destroyed you, folks, not the person next to you. You have no enemies beside yourself. See if you can accept that. Ask yourself whether you can accept that. You have no enemies beside yourself. If you're pointing at anyone else and saying, that is my enemy, you're actually pointing your finger at God. Dare I say. Yes or no? Yeah. Even to the God believers in the room, right? If you point your finger at anyone else, you're pointing a finger at a brother, and that is a creation of God. How dare you? God doesn't create enemies for you. Give or deny, You are your own enemy. No one else is. So who's your friend then? Who's your friend then? You are your own enemy. No one else. A mind that is laden with ignorance is your enemy. A mind that bears wisdom is your friend. So, are you chittas? Do the chittas make you up? Or are you? Or is all there is? No, I'm getting the grammar wrong there. Huh? Aren't you just chittas? What are you if not just a bunch of chittas? And there's only one at any given time. You are just a chitta. You can't have multiple chittas. So each one of these, this is on a dimension of time. There's only one of these at any given time. At any given moment, you're either seeing something, smelling something, tasting something, thinking something, feeling something. One of these six things is all you do. You can't be doing two things at once. So when even scientists today, they believe that, you know, you can't multitask, that is true. You can't multitask. Although you feel like you're multitasking, what you're really doing there is, because chittas flow so rapidly, one after the other, in very quick succession, there is never a gap between any two chittas. You're just constantly switching yourself from one to the next task. But each chitta only doing one thing at once. But having said all this, you still have this question. Okay, Swami Nasa, so these are my chittas, I get that. No, you didn't get it. These are not your chittas. Because then you ask this question, Swami Nasa, okay, so these are the chittas, so whose chittas are they? That's the problem. When you have these chittas that are pure, by pure I mean they are free of ignorance, these are just chittas and that's an arahant. But when ignorance takes over, now, there is the ignorance that there is such a thing called an existence, such a thing called a self. When the mind wants something, and the mind wants it really bad, this is how people go crazy. Right? Remember Bhattacharya? She was on the verge of it. She was on the verge of it, but fortunately she came across the Buddha. She was looking for her child. She was on the verge of going crazy. This is what happens when people want something they can't have. People go crazy. You know, when the mother loses her child, I've used this example before, we're going over old stuff, but it's useful as reference. When a mother loses a child, she begins to vex so deeply, so profoundly, that soon enough, she begins to create a child in her own mind. She begins to imagine, so then you have an imaginary child. Then you call her a crazy mother. In other words, you no longer need a child. You can give her just about anything, a log of wood for that matter, and she'll think that's a child. There are people who drive invisible cars. Have you seen them? I don't mean kids, I mean grown-ups. You know, next time you want to take a weekend off, like, take yourself to the mental asylum if you can. You'll see what I mean. There are patients there who believe they have a car. So what they do is they walk around the halls and the alleyways with an imaginary steering wheel in their hand. And they even shift gear. No, they do. And if there's an obstacle ahead, they apply the brakes, and sometimes they can't apply the brakes in time. And then they go and bang into them. And then they say, oh, the brakes don't work. Should get my car serviced. To you, this might sound like a joke, but that's only because you're not crazy. Or if only you knew what I know about you, you would be back with me on a bus to the monastery this afternoon. I promised you. You know, the only reason that you can go home this evening and not think twice about it is because you still don't know you're crazy. Touché. Because today you have to go back to your other half, don't you? You have to go back to your house because you are a proud housekeeper. You're a proud housewife. You're house proud. You have to go back to work because you are the boss. You're the manager. You're the supervisor. You have to go back to your workplace because you feel that you belong there. This whole sense of belonging is madness. You think to yourself that this cap belongs to this pen. The cap doesn't think that. The pen doesn't think that. What right do you have to think that the cap belongs to the pen? But you feel that. Just so much so that if I take this cap and put it on another pen and leave it out here, before you leave this room, you will come back. As I'm looking away, you'll take the cap and put it back on in its rightful plane. And you'll say, now the world is at peace. See, OCDs. Yeah? Some people have OCDs. Obsessive compulsive disorders. We have the cure for it. You don't need to drug them to death. We have the cure for it. Depression, we have the cure for it. Anxiety, we have the cure for it. Stress, we have the cure for it. You know, in this day and age, you have people who, they are struggling to identify their gender. It has become becoming mainstream now. People are struggling to identify their gender. They are born males and then they think, you know, I don't feel like a male. Then they begin to identify themselves as females. There are people who are born females and they struggle to identify themselves as females. You know, they feel like they're not in the right body. We have the answer. But when people don't realize this, they go all the way to even legalize these gender identities. And I think by now there are about 15 or 20 different gender varieties in the world. It's not my place to say whether that is right or wrong, and because I don't want to offend anyone. But here's what I'm saying. Even if you feel you're a man, let's go back to the most basic genders. If you feel you're a man and if you feel you're a woman, madam, you're crazy. Because a mind cannot be a man or a woman. A mind is just energy. What is the gender of electricity? What gender is light? What gender is heat? What gender is kinetic energy? What gender is potential energy? What gender is gravity? These are either forces or energies. What are you? You are an energy. The energy to think is the mind. And energy is an ability. The ability to illuminate is light. The energy to think is consciousness. That's what you are. The form of energy that lives within you is the energy to take on consciousness or to be conscious. That is what you are. The physical form that you are, that's chemical energy. That's physical energy. That's kinetic energy. That's heat energy. Physical energy. So you are merely the aggregation of these two things. What happens when you die? Your consciousness leaves you. That's it. It's not a grand event. But sometimes people's death is celebrated more than their birth, isn't it? Started making plans yet? Like I said, I'm already in my funeral clothes. You are not. I'm already in mine. I'm ready for death. But coming back to the point, you are just an energy. Now here's the problem. Even when I say this to you, and I try and show you evidence to the fact that you are just energy, there's still a voice at the back of your head which is asking this question. But, Swami Nanzer, me, I, this me, and my mother. You can't just say that she's just energy. She's my mother. And I love her. You can't just say that she's just energy. Maybe it's mother's energy. But mother's there. And then on this side, I have my father. You can't just say that that's just energy. I can understand if you're suggesting that this is my father's energy. That okay, I can come to terms with that. But how can you say that there's just energy and no father there? It's all because you're crazy. Your mind creates an illusion. It all happens because the mind vexes. You know, if you want this pen, and you're really upset and really bothered by the fact that you don't have this pen, there are two ways in which I can make you happy. Actually, there's a third, but if you ignore the Dhamma, there are two ways in which I can make you happy. Care to name what those two methods are? Number one, I can give you the pen. That's the obvious one. You don't get any brownie points for that. What's the second method? Give you either something else or give you nothing at all and convince you that I have given you the pen. Aren't you still happy? I'm going to make one more move and you'll be checkmate. Ready? Tell me how love works. Tell me how love works. Do they really have to love you for you to want to be with them? Or do you just need to think that they love you? When you cry for someone's love, when you weep for their love, when you beg for someone's love, there are two ways in which they can make you happy. One is to actually feel love within themselves, and now you're happy about that. But then the truth is, you can never know. And then there's a second method. What is that? Just convince you that they love you, and love you nothing, not at all. And love you not at all. As long as you think that I love you, that's enough, right? Isn't that what you want? You just want to know that I love you. I don't really need to love you. You just need to feel that I love you. That is because love is a very, very mental thing. I mean, it is mental, yes. I don't mean in that sense for now. Love is a mental affair. It's a purely mental affair. How do you know the person who walks up to you and says, I love you, honey, please believe me when I tell you I was not with someone last night? How do you know? Isn't that why you can be fooled? Because when it comes to matters of the mind, you can be fooled because you can't read another person's mind. Right? So in the same way, as long as you perceive that what you want you have, you're okay. So coming back to the pen again, there are two ways I can make you happy if you wanted this pen. One is, I give you the actual pen. Two is, put the pen to a side and I have a magic wand in my hand, abracadabra, and now you think you have a pen. You're just holding on to your finger and you think you have a pen. We are at checkmate, but I'd like to take another move, if I may. I can double checkmate. Tell me how sensuality works. Oh, I'm bursting all these bubbles. I don't know whether I should be doing this today. I'm making life difficult for you, aren't I? I should stop this. So we go back to a fairy tale. Once upon a time, in a faraway land, what do you want? Do you want a fairy tale or do you want the real? Do you want the truth? Can you stomach the truth though? I don't know. That's the problem I have. Can you bear it? But this comes with a warning. Things might happen. Well, I was just rushing away some fluff. Things might happen. Then don't come up and tell me, but Swaminarayan, why did you tell me these things, Swaminarayan? I was living a happy life, Swaminarayan, with my wife and my children and my this and my that and the other. Now you've completely ruined my head. And now I see the world in a different way. How can I undo this, Swaminarayan? I don't have a control set, unfortunately. In this business, there's no undo. Because what you have seen, you have seen. Once you see the truth, there's no going back. Right? So there's the blue pill and there's the red pill. You pick one. By being here, you have chosen to pick the red pill. If you do that, there's no going back. May I proceed? Or you can proceed. And there's the door. But here's the thing, right? Two things need to happen. One, you need the Dhamma, but two, on your side, you need merits. See, the Dhamma can make logical sense without it actually going into your comprehension. That is also possible. That is also possible. Okay? Sometimes the Dhamma makes logical sense because you're all logical thinkers. You've trained your minds to think logically about things, but it doesn't go into you, it doesn't sink in, it doesn't internalize unless you have merits. Thank God. Then we need not fear. Yeah? That's why we have an almsgiving every Sunday. So I suggest you don't stick around for that one. Because you're earning merits when you do that. You're offering something to those who make great efforts to make every stride with every breath they take to attain salvation, to attain Nibbana, to sharpen their wisdom. If that is what you give, that is what you will get. And if you are worried that you will one day have enough wisdom to understand this and this will sink, the penny will drop one day. Right now it's just rolling around. You know, when you just flip a coin, not flip a coin, but this, what do you say? Turn a coin? Yeah? When you do that, it just keeps circling itself until it once dips into the slit, falls into the slit. That will happen for you one day if you have the merits for it. Until then, I can only give you rhyme and reason. I can give you logic. But this logic will make sense to you when your merits mature. So, if you want salvation, there are two things we need to do. One, bring yourselves here so I can give you the Dhamma. Two, earn merits, because the merits help you solidify the Dhamma. It helps harden the Dhamma. It helps internalize the Dhamma. Don't do it on my behalf. Don't do it on anyone else's behalf. Do it if you want the answers to life's riddles. If you still suffer, ladies and gentlemen, you know that education is not the answer. If we put all of you together, right, I think we have pretty much everything we can be educated in this world. If you put all of us together. So in the name of education, we've gone as far as we can go. But education hasn't solved your problems. Getting married hasn't solved your problems. Becoming a mother hasn't solved your problems. Becoming wealthy hasn't solved your problems. Nothing solved your problems. Because nothing has yet tackled this problem. So what are you again? I was talking about sensuality. Your merits are almost made me forget it. Well, we are back. Yesterday's sermon, I was talking about this a little bit. I asked this question: why is it when people indulge in sensuality, they tend to close their eyes? Have you seen the adverts where people, you know, eat something, like say a piece of cake or something, right? On TV they show this. They're cutting the cake, eyes wide open. They're serving it on a plate, eyes wide open. They bring it to their mouth, eyes wide open. And then they open their mouth, put the cake in, eyes wide shut. Eyes closed, and now they take in the cake. Because when you close your eyes, you can imagine whatever you want. You are not obstructed by the sight of the object. You can create whatever you want in your mind. When you take a flower and you want to smell it, too far away today, what do? You go to your garden, you pick up a flower, you hold it to your nose, and what's the next thing you do? Close your eyes. What has the eyes got to do with smelling a flower? It bothers you, that's what it does. Because you want to create, you want to intensify that sensation. It's not really that you're shutting yourself from every other sense. What you're really doing is you're creating a sensual image of whatever it is that your heart desires. Because the mind is richer when it has vivid detail of all of it. The mind enjoys it when it can take inputs from sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and it weaves it all together. This is a purely mental process, ladies and gentlemen. The truth is that you can only see a single dot of color every single time. It's only a single dot of color. How do you know that what I speak is English? How is it that you can interpret this sentence? How do you understand that what I speak is English when all there are individual vibrations? Who's doing all the computation, the analysis, the adding it all up, the stitching it all up and making words out of it? How do you know where to put the pauses? How do you know where the words end? Because I'm not stopping, I'm just continuing a sentence. How do you know where the words break? But if I started speaking in a language that you don't understand, now you'll struggle. So then it's not in sound. Your mind's doing a lot of work in the background. It's taking bits of information, adding it together and creating information. It's actually taking bits of data, adding it together and creating information. That information is the world in which you live. You live in an information world. That information does not come to you from the outside. You create it. So put in data on one side, take out information from the other side. What's in the middle then? People who've done some IT, what do you have in the middle? You have a processor. Yeah? That's what your mind's doing. It's processing all this data. In other words, it's creating a world in which it likes to live. Now, a Rahatan Mahansa does the same. It happens in the mind of a Rahatan Mahansa as well. He just doesn't see dots of color. He sees the wall. He sees his flowers. But he doesn't have an expectation of any of that. Therefore, he doesn't have an image onto which he wishes to try and project. Or rather, he doesn't have an image he wishes to project on sights, on sounds, on smells, on taste and touch. Therefore, there are no expectations. What we tend to do is we have an expectation which is like a model. It's like a cast. You know, like when you make patties, you take your dough and you take the patties cutter, cookie cutter, right? And then you cut your dough, right? A Rahatan Mahansa does not have that. He doesn't try to cut out whatever comes in. What comes in is what comes in. He's okay with that. But we have expectations of what we want. And so when there's an expectation, there's always the possibility of a fulfilling the expectation, and there's also the possibility of unfulfilling the expectation, which is what leads to disappointment. So you suffer. Therefore you have sapavedana or sukavedana and dukkavedana. You are in one of these two states, or you are in a state of upeksha vedana, which is not the same upeksha that the Buddha speaks of, but this upeksha vedana is a vedana where you are suffering, looking to free yourself from that suffering. It's a vexation. We'll talk more about that later. This is just a bit of a trailer of what's coming in the future. What I want you to understand for now, this is a long journey that we are on, and you must forgive me, sometimes I tend to take you places and then leave you there and then bring you back again. Right? So you will be sightseeing. This is sometimes like the scenic tour. Okay? You get to see a bit of what's coming from time to time, but I'll be disciplined enough to try and keep you on track. But this is really interesting. But this is not studied for the sake of it being interesting. That's the other point. The Dhamma is far more interesting than anything you have learned, because it teaches you about yourself. What can be more interesting than that? What can be more interesting than that? Than the study of oneself? This is the most interesting thing. But we are not studying this for the sake of it being interesting. We are studying it for one thing, and that is to free ourselves from suffering. Come back again. Who are you? Chittas. Whose chittas? Whose chittas are you? My chittas? Your mothers and fathers? No, you are chittas, that's it. It's wrong to think that it is your chitta, because yourness, your highness, yourness is a creation of ignorance within the chitta. Let me say that again. This sense of me, the sense of I, the sense of self, and therefore the sense of you, he, she, it, and so on, these are all creations in a chitta. It's an illusion of a chitta. A chitta arises when the eye and an object comes into contact, or when sound and ear comes into contact, when smell and a taste come into contact, right? That's when consciousness arises. This I have represented. Alright, fine. One chitta, arising and passing away. You can think of it like a pulse of energy. That's all it is. It's just a pulse of energy. A pulse of energy that just consciousness. That's it. It conceives and it passes away. The whole purpose of chitta, of a chitta, is to conceive. Aramana vijana lakkanam chitta. Aramana is an object. Like I said, the eye comes into contact with sight. Sight is the object there. So when the eye comes into contact with sight, a chitta is born. Meaning, consciousness is born. Meaning, you have just conceived the sight. You have become aware of the sight. That is you. Your awareness. See, trees, they're not aware. Mountains, they're not aware. The sun and the moon, they're not aware, simply because they don't have what? Consciousness. But they have heat. See, they have that kind of energy. What they don't have is a consciousness type of energy, which is what you have. You are only different from the tree outside or these four walls because these things have potential energy. They have kinetic energy. They have heat energy. They have chemical energy. Whereas your body has all these as well. But in addition to that, you also have what we call mind energy or consciousness, which is the energy to perceive, the energy to conceive a thought. That's what you are. Then why then do you feel that you are an identity? Why then do you feel that you are an individual and different to the next person? It's because that is also conceived. That is also created by the mind. It's also conceived. Just as the sight was conceived, yourness is also conceived. Yourself is conceived. It does not come in the sight. You have to conceive it. You know, it's like a woman is not born pregnant, is she? She has to become pregnant. In the same way, a chitta is not born with a sense of self. It has to create the sense of self. The difference between you and an arahant is the arahant does not perceive a self. But a citta arises. This is the same in an arahant. When you present an object in front of an arahant's eye, they perceive the object. You perceive yourself and an entity of an object. The arahant perceives no self. They perceive a manifestation of an object, not an entity. These are two words that you need to understand. And we'll be talking about this a lot more. We've spoken about it in the past. We've done a lot of that on Saturday sermons as well, right? Which you are at liberty to go and visit whenever you have the time. But we'll be talking about this more and more. We, non-arahants, we perceive entities. An arahant perceives a manifestation. Very similar to when I asked you the question, what is it that makes up this pen? Right? The answer came to you, atoms make up this pen, Swami answered. So now you're talking about atoms and you're also talking about a pen, aren't you? See, in your mind you believe that the atoms have made up this pen. Now this pen is an entity to you. It's an object. But what is this pen after all? If not the very atoms, but combined and arranged in a specific configuration. Do you see the difference? But then of course you say, but what about the atoms themselves? Aren't they atoms? What makes up an atom? Now you'll say electrons, neutrons and protons, they make up atoms. Really? Do electrons, protons and neutrons make up atoms? Or is an atom electrons, protons and neutrons? Just in that arrangement. You see, take an atom, or whatever you might think of as an atom. Take the electrons out and put into a box. Take the proton, put into one box. Take any neutrons it might have and put into another box. Now where's the atom? Where did the atom go? Did it take shelter somewhere? Did it go and hide? Did it run away? The atom that was there earlier, where did it go? So where was it then? It was only in your mind. That is the entity that your mind perceived. Because here's what the mind does. It stitches data together. It stitches bits of data together and then it entitifies it. I don't even know whether that's a real word, but you're going to have to live with that. It entitifies things. You understand the word an entity, which is a standalone object, right? Complete on its own. It can, you know, self-surviving, self-sustaining object. That is what the mind perceives, and it projects that onto this arrangement. Just like these flowers, ladies and gentlemen. What do you see here? You see more than just the flowers, don't you? Yeah. You see this arrangement? What might you call this? A floral decoration, a bouquet? Yeah, you might call it a bouquet. Where is the bouquet? Where is the entity of a bouquet? It's a manifestation. Meaning, these flowers, by virtue of being present where they are, okay? The individual flowers, by virtue of being present where they are, in that arrangement, in that composition, manifest that. I say manifest, like I expect you to understand what I mean by that. So, I apologize for the drama. It's not intended. But I'm really trying to get across the meaning that I have in my mind to you, and words always fail me. So I apologize for that profusely. I'm not trying to do a drama here. Okay? But they manifest. What else can I say? I hope you understand what I mean by the word manifest. This is not an entity. There is no bouquet here. What there is a manifestation of a bouquet. If you take out each of those flowers, now where's the bouquet? Where did it go? So if you bring the flowers back together again, where did the bouquet come from? Did it just appear out of thin air? If you take the flowers apart, then where does the bouquet go? Does it disappear into thin air? But right now, don't you think that there's a bouquet here? In fact, so much so that if I took one flower out of it, how would you describe that? Swaminathan did what? He plucked a flower from the bouquet. Let's take another flower. Now what did he do? So this has five flowers, okay? Right? Let's assume this has five flowers. So I take the first flower. What do you say? Swaminathan took one flower from the bouquet. Right. Now Swaminathan goes and tries to take the second flower. He takes the second flower. Now what do you say? Swaminathan took the second flower from the bouquet. He takes the third flower. Now what did he do? You see where this is going? He took the third flower from the bouquet, and now there are two flowers left in the bouquet. Right. I take the fourth flower. Now what did Swaminathan just do? He took the fourth flower from the bouquet, and now there's just one flower left in the... So one flower is a bouquet. Come on, think about this. Is one flower a bouquet? So at what point does it stop being a bouquet? I have a better question for you. At what point did it become a bouquet? Yes. It's merely the accumulation of causes that manifest a bouquet. I'm not suggesting for one bit that there is no such thing called a bouquet. There is, but what there isn't is an entity of a bouquet that is never changing. There is no such thing called an entity of a bouquet. Now don't ask me, Swaminathan, is it an impermanent bouquet? No, what I'm saying is, there is no bouquet as such to become impermanent. It's only a manifestation. When the right causes come together, that is what we call a manifestation. Now take yourself, your bodies for a second. I refer back to you again because, you know, this is where you have the biggest problem. You know, you don't have a problem with bouquets. The problem you have is with yourselves. Yeah, who's your biggest enemy? Of course. Right? When one hair grows grey, that's the end of the world. That's why you color it and you dye it and you do all that because, you know, oh my God, I'm growing old. How can I bear this? Yeah, that's because you sense an eye. That's the problem. You sense an I, you sense a self, so therefore old age becomes your problem. Old age is a creation of the mind because you think something existed to grow old. That's the entity that you create. I was there and I was younger, then I went to middle age and now I'm growing old. One day I'll be very old and that wouldn't be very nice. See, where was that entity? It started when you were born. And then it grows older, and then it decays and it dies. See, you are talking about an entity. You're giving a story. People like stories, don't they? People like stories because their minds like to think in terms of stories. But there are no such things called stories. All there are manifestations, pachupanna, meaning manifestations that are a product of the causes that are present right now. That's all there are. No two things are connected to each other, ladies and gentlemen, although you think you are connected to your husband or your wife by heart and soul. Till death do us part, you say. That's how you feel connected, and because of that you suffer. That's the only thing. It's not that I envy that you have a husband and a wife, okay? You know that. I don't envy. You suffer. I mean, if you can live a married life without suffering, I don't have a problem. You come up to me and say, Swaminathan, I've been married for the last 25 years, and would you believe me, Swaminathan, there's never been a day. You want to complete that sentence? If you want to come up and say, Swaminathan, there's never been a day that I have been unhappy. I've always been happy, and that happiness has only grown from the day I got married. For the last 25 years, I've just been going happier and happier and happier and happier, and I'm just getting too happy now. I can't contain myself. I feel at this rate, I might become a Buddha. When it comes to my golden jubilee, I might actually become a Buddha. That's how happy I feel. You know it's not so. You know that what you had in the honeymoon period, you know, lasted along with it, or died along with it. And there's a reason for that. Pleasure only comes from relief from vexation. When you long to be with someone, right, and then you finally unite with that person, that longing is no longer there. You know, you can only get pleasure out of scratching yourself because you have a rash. But if you keep scratching it, after a point, it becomes painful. Then you have to stop for a little while. Just for a little while. And then what do you do again? You scratch it again. When does the rash cure itself if you just keep on doing that? Never. This is why you live a rash of a life. Looking to expect happiness from a marriage is like scratching a rash. Just don't keep scratching it every day. Because you won't get happiness that way. Scratch it on Tuesdays. And the rest of the week, just let it be. Set aside a day of the week where you scratch your rash with each other. You get together and you scratch a rash. But take it in whichever way you understand this. I can't be more articulate about this than that. Scratch your rash one day a week, and the rest of the week, let it be. It feels better that way. Why? Because pleasure only comes out of relief from vexation. Please understand that for your sake. What if you could be without a rash? Then you need not scratch. That is the alternative that the Dhamma offers to you. You know, I see people in the audience. They still have youth left in them. You still have youth on your side. You know you're not going to have this forever. There comes a point where the mind is willing, but the flesh is weak, in another sense of the word. Your mind will be willing one day. You will understand, yeah, it makes sense. You know what, I really need to do something about this. Have you not seen the grannies in the temples? Every poor day they come and sit around the temple. Right? They are awake until Panatipata Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhyam. That's all. And then they wake up again for the almsgiving. And then now they're too, they've eaten too much. Because their bodies are weak. After a hefty meal, now they have to sleep again. And the Swami Nasa comes and hears a sermon. He's talking about Paticchasamuppada. Because he feels, out of compassion, he has to give the Dhamma to these people and help them to understand something. But no Paticchasamuppada is going into their heads. Because they're asleep. They're fast asleep. Too old now. And then, after that, they wake up, so them do some pirit chanting or something, go to the Bodhimalu and offer some flowers, light up some incense sticks, maybe light up some oil lamps, right? At the end of the evening, they do a merit transfer, and then they go home. And they think they have achieved salvation. Because now, they feel like the last part of my life, the last 10 years I've been going every poya day to the temple, and I've been observing still religiously. Without fail, I've been going to the temple. Your parents are probably saying these stories already to you. And yet on their deathbed, with no refuge. Because then they wonder, why after all these years of me going to the temple, has the Buddha not come to save me? Why has the Dhamma not saved me? Why do I have to suffer like this? Pointless going to these temples, pointless giving to these monks. Then they make up their own stories. Well, why are the monks to be blamed for their weakness? How should the sasana be? Why should the sasana take the blame for their weakness? Why did they leave it too late to start? Because of bad association. That's why the Buddha says, "Nabaje papa ke mitte, nabaje purisa adhame." Don't associate with people who encourage you to do bad things. And bad things don't necessarily mean sins. I need you to start thinking at another level, folks. Bad things include, let's go watch a movie this weekend. Don't sermon 1 week, you miss it. What's a big deal? Watch it online. Let's go watch the movie tonight. What you don't realize is that's taking a great leap backwards. You know, living your lay lives and doing the Dhamma and the Sasana is like taking 3 steps forward and 4 steps back. At least you're taking 3 steps forward. Remember, I didn't say 3 steps forward and 2 steps back. You're always taking 4 steps back, but now you started taking 3 steps forward. So at least at this rate, you're only moving back 1 step at a time, whereas previously you were moving back 4 steps at a time. The rate at which you move back has reduced. You haven't started moving forward yet. For most people, you are the exception. Okay? I say that because I don't want to hurt anyone. I don't want to hurt your feelings. Because if you feel antagonized when you're here and you fall out with me or the Swaminarayanse or the Sasana or the monastery or whatever, then you are again lost. You blow with the wind. Like a dead leaf falling off a tree. Blow with the wind again. If you have merit, someone else will catch you before you fall. Today, you have been fortunate enough that the Swaminarayanse has come and caught you before you fell. You are blowing in the wind. You don't agree? You are just blowing in the wind. Now you say the answer is blowing in the wind. That's because you are listening to the Dhamma. And so was I. I was blowing in the wind until my teacher caught me. And he said, let's give you some meaning to life. Let's give you a purpose for this existence. Let's make someone out of you. Someone useful, someone worthwhile. Come on. And I was willing to go with him. Aren't you glad that I made that choice? Aren't you glad that I made that choice? So what are you waiting for then? If you were glad that I made that choice, what are you waiting for? 85? Is that what you're waiting for? 85? The big 80? You know, to whatever degree you can do this, please, ladies and gentlemen, you know, do it. Do it with some earnestness. Be heedful. Time is not on your side, remember. Every tick is one day closer to the end of your time on this earth. Every second, you know, this second arm has been ticking, talking, ticking, talking, ticking, talking. Counting you down. I don't know why people celebrate birthdays, to be honest. Today, you know, I fail to understand why people celebrate birthdays. The only reason people celebrate birthdays is because they don't look it the other way around. Yeah? Because they say, I have lived 25 years on this earth. Woohoo! What they don't remember is now it's 25 years less from their limited lifetime. That they don't see. And here's the thing. Maybe their lifespan on this earth is 25 years and one day. No? If they knew that, do you think they'd celebrate the 25-year birthday? If on the day you were born, you were told when you were going to die, I tell you, you won't be celebrating your birthdays. The only reason you celebrate your birthdays is because you don't know when you're going to die. Prove me wrong if you can. Because you think it will come someday. You don't know when that someday is going to be. If you came to the monastery for once in a while, then you get to talk to the people who come in. because we get cancer patients all the time. And no, they're not all 80 plus. We are seeing more teenagers now, these days. It's becoming more common. More teenagers. Seventeens, eighteens, cancers. Yeah, just the very fact that you managed to say stay unscathed for all this time, simply alone is a miracle. Because I'll tell you this, we've done more bad than good in our journey in samsara, folks. You know, even in this life, right, most of us have done more bad than good. Because it takes a lot to do something good. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a whole environment. You need noble friends. You need good friends around you to do something good. How often do your friends come up to you and say, let's go to the temple today? Versus how many friends come up to you and say, shall we go for a drink today? Who introduced you to pornography? Your best friend. And you expect that best friend to invite you to go to the temple? To attend Nibbana? Really? Who gave you the first www.com? Your best friend. Maybe even your brother. Maybe your sister. Your closest allies. And your parents trusted them to be with you and keep you safe. But little did they know that you are going to come out of that completely spoilt. And then from that day on, it's become a habit. And one thing led to the other, that led to the other, that led to the other. And today you can't break free of them. And here's the thing, the mind can never be satisfied. What today you give the mind to see, tomorrow the mind wants to smell. If you give the two of them, then the following day the mind wants to taste. That's why it's just not enough to look at someone. You brought them home, didn't you? Yes or no? Yeah. It was not enough just to look at them. I mean, you saw her. Why couldn't you just please yourself with that? That was not enough because you wanted to listen to her whenever you wanted. Vexation. I say her, you think him, whatever, right? Works both ways. And when that was not enough, it was not enough to listen to her, you had to smell her. And that was not enough. Need I say more? These are not meant to be mocking or scornful remarks because I've been there, done that myself. I didn't grow on a tree. I lived a very mundane, very regular life like every one of you. So I can understand where you come from. I understand your heartbeat. I understand the rhythm, the pulse of your heart. I understand that. We are in this together, folks. I'm not undermining you. I'm not looking down upon you. In fact, I'm looking up at you. I can see a future you up there. Why are you still down here is what I'm asking you. My teacher could do that with me. Today I'm trying to do that with you. I can see you up there. Why are you still here? I'm asking you. It's not me who's undermining you. Who is? Yourselves. Because you think you are less capable than what you are capable of. That is why. You think, here's what you think. Especially the young people in the audience. This side of 80. This is what you think. You think that I will never be able to live without my computer. You think that. You think you'll never be able to live without your computer. You think you'll never be able to live without your computer games. You think you'll never be able to live without your phone. That's what you think. Die and see. You think you'll never be able to live without your pizza. You think you'll never be able to live without your chocolate. You think you'll never be able to live without your wine. You think you'll never be able to live without watching sports on TV. That's the position you've given to yourselves. Why do you undermine yourselves like this? I know that you can. You're telling me, no, Swami, no, we can't. As I say, die and see whether you can or cannot. Won't you die? Won't you die? So at the moment of death, are you going to say, no, I can't die because I can't leave my phone, I can't leave my computer, I can't leave my wife, I can't leave my children, I can't die. Or are you just going to die? Aren't you? You're just going to die. So you can leave them, right? What about the things that you had from your previous life? Did you take them with you? Isn't that why you had to start again? So aren't you doing just fine without them? Aren't you doing just fine without them? So were you not able to leave them behind? You were. You just didn't take the jump. Because you kept telling yourself, I can't, I can't, I can't, I can't, I can't. Of course, what you think you are, that's it. If you think you can't, you can't. If you think you can, you can. See, they can. Look, 15. 15. What can't you? You must understand, I'm not just coming here to do the sermons, right? This is not just for the sake of doing a sermon, because I can do that at the monastery. This is not just for the sake of doing a sermon, this is for your salvation. We come and do this because you tell me, Swaminanda, I'm interested in Nibbana. I want it, Swaminanda. That is why we are here, that is why we meet here. The management of the school, the chairman, the principal, right, all of them, they have given their consent for us, to us using this for free. For one reason and one reason alone. Because we have all said we want Nibbana. That's why. If you'd said, I just want to go to heaven, Swaminanda, trust me, I wouldn't come here. There are plenty other ways to get to heaven. Go to the church. Go to the mosque. Go to the kovil. Go to most other places, temples even. They will take you to heaven. This is not for heaven. This is not for heaven. This is where those in heaven need to go eventually. That is what this is for. That's why, you know, I see a lot of potential in you. I see great potential in you because you're all human lives, you know. Your minds, this is what you are. You are minds. A mind is capable of infiniteness. Your mind is capable of limitless potential. And you have, each and every one of you has that within you. I don't know why you undermine yourself so much and you think to yourself, I can't give up my phone. How do you know unless you give it up and try it for a week? How do you know? How do you know unless you give your phone up, put your phone up to your side and then listen to the Dhamma and see what the Dhamma can do for you? How do you know? There are probably people in the room thinking, I can't go, I can't give up Swaminanda. How can I give up my girlfriend? I'd die without her. Die and see? I mean, ask her to die and see. Whether you're going to die without her. This is nonsense. Don't belittle yourself so much. You are minds and you are capable of infiniteness. You are capable of limitless potential. Come out of this thinking that you are a mother. This was the crux of yesterday's talk. I keep referring to that. You think you are a mother, and therefore you limit yourself to being a mother to one child. Why? How sad. When you think you are a mother to one child, and that's all you are. You're not capable of anything more than that. How sad. When you think you're a husband, you limit yourself to being the husband to one wife, by which I don't mean. That's not what I mean. I mean, you limit your potential just to being a husband to a woman. When you are a mind that's capable of infinite potential, how sad. How sad. You were not born into this world to become a wife or a husband or a mother or a father. That's not what you were born into this world for. You were born into this world to achieve salvation, Nibbana, ultimate happiness. If you don't like to call it Nibbana, let's not call it Nibbana. But weren't you born into this world to achieve happiness? Have you? If you haven't understood the Dhamma, then of course you haven't. There's not a single soul in this world that can claim to have achieved happiness who has also not understood the Dhamma. It's not possible. It's impossible. Show me a man who says that he doesn't understand the Dhamma, but he's happy unconditionally, and I will give up my robe because he has found an easier way to attain salvation. Show me one man. Just give me one example of a man who's happy unconditionally, no Dhamma, but he claims to be unconditionally happy. With the caveat that he can't be a crazy man. Because a crazy person might think that he's happy. And that's crazy. He's a madman, if you think so. So, you know, my appeal to you folks is not for myself. I know the risk that I take getting myself into a car and bringing myself here every Sunday. Because I'm playing with death. This is a life and death game. Sometimes, you know, as people drive, we've had a narrow escape once in a while. It happens. Yeah, as careful as our drivers can be, you're careful drivers on the road, but you know it's not always up to you, right? They don't always check whether you can actually drive a car before you can get your license. Unfortunately, that's not how it always works. You've seen how people are on the road. You know, once in a while we have a narrow escape, and then I tell myself it must be the merits. But still, you know, it's a gamble. I don't like setting foot outside the monastery one bit. I mean, that's no guarantee that I'm not going to die by a rubber branch falling on my head. That's possible. Right? Or being struck by lightning. That's quite possible. But, you know, this is an extra risk we are taking. When all I have is this, I don't have 9 lives. You know, if I lose this, are you going to give it back to me? Anyone? Will you spare me yours? Will you? You might if you could, but can you? No. That's what I'm saying. That's why I said last week, we are making a huge investment in trying to uplift these lives out of misery, out of suffering. And not everyone has the potential to get this. Only those who have the merit, have the virtue to come here, at least listen to these talks online. So please do something with your lives. Don't just make this a casual encounter with the Swami Nuhanse. You know, some people like that. They have a doctor, you know, my family doctor, my family lawyer, my family engineer, my family Swami Nuhanse on their contact list. Then it feels like my life is complete. I have the family doctor, have the family lawyer, have the family Swami Nuhanse, a family monk. You know, some people are like that. You know, they just go and listen to a Dhamma talk once in a while, and then they feel that they're virtuous. It's like Varak Vendot Kelani. People think that, you know, they can just go and listen to a Dhamma sermon once in a while, and all the defilements that all the sins that they've done will simply be washed away. And it gives them a sense of Sense of satisfaction, yes. It feels like, you know, that it's okay. Just because they've been sinning, it doesn't mean that they're totally bad, because they go take themselves to the temple once in a while. But that's not how things work. You can't wash away your sins. They're not dishes. You can't just wash them away. What is done is done. Each individual demerit that you have done has been done. Each individual merit that you have done has been done. They don't cancel each other out. It's not like positive and negative that cancel each other out. That's not how it works. When it's time for it to fruition, come to fruition, each demerit will come to fruition on its own. And each merit will come to fruition on its own. What kusal will help you do, which is cleansing the mind of defilements, is to free yourself from that trap where you are simply the victim of the deeds you have done in the past. See, whether it is a meritorious deed or an unmeritorious deed, folks, no matter what comes your way, as long as the mind is constantly creating a sense of self, you suffer. Doesn't a happy, you know, a man who has a lot, does he not cry when he dies? Does he not weep when he loses the things that he's attached to, he loves? Because he has no kusal. What he has is merits. That's the difference. That's the difference between the two things. A man who is meritorious may have a lot, but that doesn't stop him from attaching himself to a lot. Right? That's kusal. That's not ping. That's kusal. A man who is demeritorious or unmeritorious will not have a lot. He will not even have the basic necessities that he might want in life. He'll be very poor. But a man who has given a lot and therefore very meritorious will have a lot. He'll be rich in that way. But they are both poor in my eyes, because they're both attached. One has what they're attached to. The other don't have what they're attached to. Therefore they both suffer. There are no winners in this game. There are only consolation prizes. If you have merits, you have a consolation prize. It's not the trophy. The trophy only comes from the sasana. That's when you work on kusala. Free yourself from attachment. And that can only come through the understanding of anicca, dukkha and anatta, which helps you to realize the Four Noble Truths. Which helps you identify what true suffering is. Not the mundane suffering that everyone talks of, but the cause of all that suffering, the root cause of all that suffering, which is a sense of self, a sense of existence. The fact that you feel that this fan exists, so therefore when this falls apart, you think that the fan is broken. That's how you perceive it. Because you see more than the pieces together. You see a whole here. You see the whole thing as one entity. You can't come out of that, not through science. Science is not going to help you come out of that. That thinking you can only come out of by understanding Buddhist philosophy. Because that is the first noble truth of suffering. That no one has ever seen without the help of a Buddha. And the cause of that suffering is attachment. Actually, the word suffering is not right really. It's okay. But if you ask me to give a word for dukkha, I wouldn't have picked suffering. Because it gives a wrong connotation. Because suffering was always in the dictionary. So therefore when the Buddha comes and says, this is dukkha, the closest match to that was suffering, and then everyone says, this is the first noble truth of suffering. But the moment you say suffering, all that context of suffering, all the connotations of suffering, they all come into your mind, and you think, okay, suffering, of course, we know suffering. So now the Buddha has nothing to do, because you already know what he's going to say. Yeah? So even if the Buddha walked up today and said, ladies and gentlemen, please come here, I have something to tell you. I'm here to talk to you about suffering. What are you going to say? Suffering, we know that. We know suffering. My grandfather also suffered. In the last years of his life, you should have seen him, Swaminanda. So Buddha, he was suffering no end. I saw him, he was suffering. See, if that was suffering, then what did the Buddha see as a bodhisattva when he went on tour? When Channa took him on a tour around the kingdom? Right? He saw an old man. If that is suffering, then he'd already seen that, right? Then he saw a sick man.
If that was suffering, he'd already seen that. And then he saw a dead man. Then he asked Channa, what's that? So it is said, Channa said, Prince, this is a dead man. It is said that he'd never seen a dead man before. Whether that is true or not, he'd never seen that there was a problem that had to be solved. I mean, let's take it at the superficial level. He'd never seen a dead man before, never seen a sick man before, never seen an old man before. Let's just assume that can be true. Okay? Even if it were, then he'd already seen those things, hadn't he? So then what is the jati paccha, jara, marana, shoka, parideva that he comes up with later on once he has become a Buddha? If the two things are the same, he's seen that before. So what's the new revelation that he has upon becoming a Buddha? Then we have to come to the conclusion, either the Buddha was a big fat liar, or we didn't understand what he meant when he said, I have seen the truth. Death, I have seen you for the first time. Disease, I have seen you for the first time. Decay, I have seen you for the first time. Never have I seen you before. And no man, no deva, no mara has ever seen this before. And from henceforth, the Buddha, or someone who has heard this from the Buddha, will be able to teach mankind what jati is, what jara is, what vyadi is, what marana is, things that they would never see without the help of a Buddha. It cannot be the same thing. It is not. Today I can tell that to you with conviction. It is not the same thing. They are worlds apart. But I know you dread your mother's passing away. You think that's going to cause you suffering. That's because you see a mother to pass away. That's why. You don't see just the flowers, you see the bouquet. So therefore, even if I talk to you about your mother passing away, just the thought of it brings you fear. If I talk to you about your child getting into an accident and dying, just the thought of it might send a shiver down your spine, but that's because you see the bouquet. You can't think of it as simply individual things that come together as a manifestation. That is what a body is. A body is a collection of things. A body of water is a collection of water. Therefore, you are simply a collection of things. You are not an entity. But your mind constantly sees it, perceives it as an entity. And therefore, the misery and the agony that comes with that is inevitable. Gosh. And I thought I'd been speaking for about 10 minutes. I have some things to show you today, but we don't have time now. But please don't undermine yourselves. You are capable of a lot more than you think you are. Today you think you can't live with your TV screen. How do you know if you haven't tried? You think you can't live with your makeup kit. There are probably young women in the room who think, I can't live with my makeup. Can I become an anagarika with my makeup kit? Because you are now a slave to your makeup kit. You are no longer the master. You are a slave to everything you are attached to. And you are here talking about freedom. Every year we celebrate freedom. On the 4th of February we celebrate freedom. Freedom from what? If you are not free from yourselves, what are you free from? What is the meaning of that freedom, folks? If you are not free from yourselves, please do yourselves a favor. You know, experience what I'm talking to you about. Just trial it for 2 years. Trial it. If it doesn't work, go back home. What have you lost? 2 years. What have you lost now? 50 years.
Ask people who are over 50, if they had heard this when they were younger, if they wouldn't have started on this journey as an anagarika, they say, yes, Swami Nansa, we would have. But now it's too late. And that's why those who are 20 are waiting until they are 50, so that they can come up with the same excuse. Your becoming an anagarika or an anagarika is a burden to the monastery. It is, because that's another mouth to feed. It's another head over which we have to put a shelter. It's another body under which we have to put a bed. It's another person we have to give a teacher to. It's another person we have to look after. So then why am I crazy to invite you? Because to me, suffering is suffering. There is no such thing called your suffering and my suffering. That's why even an arahant goes around delivering people from suffering. Because even when they have freed themselves from suffering entirely, why do they go around delivering that service? Why did the Buddha go for 45 long years preaching the Dhamma? If he had already achieved his salvation, he could have just gone and entered Parinibbana, right? On the Mara's invitation. That's what the Mara said. Sir, now that you have attained Parinibbana, what the heck are you doing? Just go and attain Nibbana. Pass away, will you? That's what the Mara said. But the Buddha doesn't see his suffering and someone else's suffering. You do because of self. In your mind, you create the illusion of self. So therefore, even suffering becomes yours. The worst thing in this world, you make your own. You take ownership of it. Suffering doesn't belong to anyone. Just like happiness doesn't belong to anyone. These are merely manifestations. But once you, if you understood that, then of course suffering is not there. That's the thing. So, finally, I'll say this once in a while. I can't say this every day because there are other things we have to talk about. Once in a while, I'll remind you. Because some things they have to just, you know, you have to drill it into thick skulls, right? Once is not enough, twice is not enough, sometimes you have to hear it 100 times before someone's convinced. There are those in the room for whom life has been fair, it has left you some room to take a different path, to choose an alternative, to actually make a difference in your life. And actually, you know what? Pay the debt that you owe to your parents, the debt that you owe to your teachers, the debt that you owe to everyone who cared about you. Because if you die unhappy, you die with that debt. Remember, everything your parents did, everything your teachers did, everything your friends, your loved ones did, they did to keep you happy. But if you die unhappy, if you die crying, if you die sad, then your debt remains unpaid. I'm paying my debt. I'm not going to die unhappy. I will die a happy man. My parents will be glad that they put in the time and effort to bring me into this world. My mother will be pleased that she kept me in her womb for 9 months, brought me into this world. She fed me. She took care of me. My father will be pleased that he broke every sweat and he toiled day in, day out to help me grow up. And my teachers will be proud that they will have taught me everything I know today, because they did all that for one thing. If they did all that because they cared about me, what one thing did they want from me? To be what? To be happy. So the only way I can repay that service, that debt, is by dying a happy man, so that they know. Because did they not know I was going to die? Was that a surprise to them? No, they all knew I was going to die, but they still did what they had to do for me because they wanted me to die happy. That was the difference. Die sad or die happy? I'm going to die happy. Are you? Are you going to repay your debt to your parents, to this nation that taught you for free? We are all indebted to free education. Are you going to pay your debt? I am. Some people might ask, becoming a monk, are you not in debt to the nation that taught you for free? You got free education out of the system, now you're playing truant. Now you're skiving yourself out of this.
No. This nation taught me so that I could be happy and I could help other people be happy. And that's what I'm doing. I'm not going to die indebted to my country. I'm not going to die indebted to my parents or my teachers. I'm paying off that debt. Are you? It is your taxes that taught me, that gave me my education. I'm paying back your taxes. Because if I today worked somewhere in an office, worked in a job, I'd be paying my taxes to repay what the money you spent to teach me. I'm doing that now. I'm repaying those debts. You earned money because you thought money would bring you happiness. So it was not really money that you wanted. You want happiness, right? That's what I'm giving you. That is the Mahasangha. Not something special or peculiar about me. That is the Mahasangha. The long and short of all this is, I believe that I am a mission. I'm not just on a mission. I believe that I am a mission. Are you? Why can't you be? Don't undermine yourselves. Don't belittle yourselves. Don't insult yourselves by thinking that you couldn't live 1 week without a phone in your hand. How sad. Look at how much power you have given over yourself to Mark Zuckerberg. Today he sets the agenda for your day. Yes or no? He works out the agenda for your day today. He decides when you go to sleep. He decides what you do the moment you wake up every morning. He decides where your eyes are as you have breakfast. He decides. Who is he to you? He's only another man who's suffering. Why don't you let me set your agenda for the day? They have. He has. Why don't you let the Buddha set your agenda for the day? Because it's what you do every day that will take you to greatness, not what you do on one single occasion, one single instance. Consistency is very important. Little things every day. That's the secret to success. So let the Mahasangha set your agenda for a day. Let the Mahasangha set your table for the day. You know, just trial it for 2 years. See what's going to happen. If you lose out, 2 years lost. If you get out of a bad marriage, 10 years lost. But you still get into the marriage anyway, don't you? 10 years lost. If you have a kid and he dies because he has a hole in the heart, after 5 years, right? That's 5 years lost. What have you gained? Nothing. People are so willing to take such risks with their lives, but they're not willing to sacrifice 2 years for themselves. I don't get the logic behind that. Please don't think I'm telling you off, although it might come across like that. It's not meant to be. It's only because I care. I'm passionate about this. That much I am. I'm very passionate about this. But your coming or not does not depend on my happiness does not depend on that. If it did, then I'm no better than the next. But I know this, there is no such thing called your happiness and my happiness. There is no such thing called your suffering and my suffering. We are all working at eradication of suffering. And I can see suffering there. I can see suffering here. So while I'm working on suffering, I try and do what I can. In any way, any case, you know, when I'm gone, don't you worry, I won't bother you. Honestly, I'm not going to come back to trouble you. Right? But I'm around, I think, 37, something like that now. I've lost count. I only think of how old I am when the doctor asks, how old are you? And then I have to count. lose count of time. I don't celebrate a birthday, so I don't know how old I am. But when the doctor asks, I have to let them know. Because I don't have an age, do I? I'm a chitta. How old is a chitta? 37? So if, you know, conventionally, if I'm, the body is 37 years old, okay, this might last maybe another 40 years. After that, I won't bother you. Promise. Mark my words, I won't bother you. So I certainly won't be bothering your grandchildren. Okay? So don't you worry. But please, do what is right for yourselves. You're glad that you have the Mahasangha who care about you deeply and passionately. Your dhāne cannot make me happy. Aren't you glad about that? Aren't you glad that your dhāne doesn't make me happy? So that if you give me a good dhāne, I give you a good sermon. If it's just rice and curry, then jataka story. Your dhāne doesn't make me happy. But I'm happy if you can work towards your freedom to eradicate suffering. Because that's what I'm doing. There's only one way to make a teacher happy. I've discovered that in my learnings about life. There's only one way to make a teacher happy, and that is to further his or her course. That's how. There's only one way to make a teacher happy. If you think you see a teacher here, there's only one way to make this teacher happy. That is to further the same course on which I am. I'm not here for the dying. I'm here for salvation. I'm here for Nibbana. If you want to make me happy, work towards that. With every ounce of energy that you have within you. Don't condemn yourselves just because you're elderly. Don't condemn yourselves because you're married. Don't condemn yourselves because you're a mother or a father and you're too busy. You have no right to do that. Because you don't even belong to yourselves. So you have no right to decide whether you should die happy or unhappy. You think you belong to you. That's the truth. Right? Let's conclude then. Let us all take a moment to transfer the merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, inviting the Swami Mahasi to deliver the sermon, listening to the sermon and creating a conducive environment for all to come along, sit comfortably, listen to the Dhamma and attain to their salvation. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we must be to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief freelance of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us transfer these merits to my teacher Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident in the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to the friends of the monastery who, for the sake of merits, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, as well as anyone and everyone who've gone the extra mile on our behalf, who've helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to protect and fulfill the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who passed away in our name, our loved ones, our forefathers and our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and enjoy our practice to Nibbana in peace and comfort. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to all members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as friends and foe who have passed away in the war. Let us also transfer these merits to those who lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, as well as the pandemics, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, friends and acquaintances to us. They will have gone the extra mile on our behalf and left no stone unturned. Out of compassion and loving kindness and an abundance of gratitude towards all of them, let us transfer all the merits we have acquired throughout samsara to all. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, they redeem themselves to be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahat Theranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnanidatnva Desha ginnan nidatnva Moha ginnan nidatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatnva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatnva Raga gininiveva Desha gininiveva Moha gininiveva
sapaladeva nivan sapaladeva nivan sapaladeva
tunduvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen silu loka silu satteyoma nibbana parama sukhen sukita daravetva sadhu sadhu sadhu.